When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Okay, so welcome back everyone to the Explaining History podcast. I am thrilled today to be joined by Chad Williams, who is the Samuel J. Augusta Spector Professor of History and African American Studies at Brandeis University, published author, and who has written in a variety of periodicals, journals, and has been a kind of at the forefront, I think, of writing about Du Bois for some time. And our conversation today is a discussion about his latest book, The Wounded World, which is really about the kind of the complex and quite painful relationship that Du Bois had with the First World War. For those of you that aren't familiar with W.E.B. Du Bois, perhaps the place to begin is talking about who he was. So firstly, Chad, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Okay. And perhaps we can start off by talking a little bit about who Du Bois was and what his sort of significance is.
Du Bois is arguably the greatest Black intellectual scholar in American history. He's a truly singular figure. No one like him lived a truly remarkable life. He lived 95 years. He was born in Great Barrington, Massachusetts in 1868, just a few years after the end of the Civil War, during the beginnings of Reconstruction. He died in Accra, Ghana on August 27th, 1963, literally the day before the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, where Martin Luther King Jr. gave his famous I Have a Dream speech. So he spanned just an incredible amount of time.
Yeah.
And during his lifetime, he was really at the forefront of pretty much every major issue facing African Americans and other peoples of African descent. Yeah. He was an accomplished scholar, the first African American to receive a PhD from Harvard University. He was a pioneer in history, sociology, wrote 22 single-authored books, literally hundreds of articles and essays, laid the groundwork for the modern civil rights movement as we know it today. Mm-hmm. Was one of the co-founders of the NAACP. He was really incomparable. And when we think about kind of the model of the scholar activist, particularly as it relates to African American history, Du Bois is the template.
And it's extraordinary, isn't it, that, you know, perhaps if you were to ask somebody about a 20th century intellectual, they might say George Orwell. They might say perhaps somebody like, you know, one of the Russian dissidents, somebody like kind of Sakharov or something like that. Probably Orwell, I imagine, is the name that most people would cite. But in terms of the significance of, you mentioned Du Bois as being, you know, the most significant Black intellectual of the 20th century. I would arguably put him in the top 5 to 10 most significant intellectuals of the 20th century in his dissection of exploitation, race, poverty, class. I mean, he talks about things that range, in fact, far beyond the experience of African Americans, and looks at the kind of the functionings of empire and capital and all these other things. So he lays down a big, you know, a big chunk of what we think of as kind of modern radical thought. You know, it's a bit of a nebulous kind of description.
Yeah.
And if you were a sort of a Black civil rights activist in, say, 1963 or 1965 at Selma, what would your relationship have been to Du Bois? Is he the person you'd have read? Is he the person you'd been paying attention to?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question. It really speaks to the need to take Du Bois in the broad span of his life and to recognize how complex he was and how he evolved over time, how his thinking, how his radicalism evolved over time. So Du Bois in 1963 is very different than Du Bois in 1903, for example. He publishes The Souls of Black Folk, that timeless book where he writes about the problem of the 20th century being the problem of the color line, one of the most prophetic statements of the 20th century. Du Bois in 1963 was effectively persona non grata in terms of the mainstream civil rights movement in the context of the Cold War. He had joined the Communist Party, kind of thumbing his nose at the United States government. And many mainstream civil rights leaders, including many of those at the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, had distanced themselves very intentionally from Du Bois. However, there were certainly Black radicals who continued to embrace Du Bois, saw him as a hero, saw him as an intellectual model, continued to read Du Bois, including some of his most radical works published in the 1950s and early 1960s. So I think Du Bois, particularly at the end of his life, speaks to the complexity of the Black civil rights struggle and how we need to think of it capaciously, how there were different ideological strands and movements within the larger movement itself.
Yeah, of course. And this is always the case when you look at a particular movement, whether it is, the movement for Black civil rights or something else. There are this sort of cacophony of different voices saying different things and often arguing with one another, saying, well, that's not the strategy. We can't compromise here. It's interesting that King himself, Dr. Martin Luther King himself, sort of towards the end of his life, actually kind of took an identical journey, but a similar kind of move to the left. You know, he began to critique, say, well, you know, is the treatment of African Americans really part of the functioning of American capitalism? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, his life was cut short in 1968 before perhaps that line of thought could have continued. So looking at the significance of Du Bois there and where he fits within the civil rights movement. I guess a lot of people listening, when they think of the civil rights movement, they think of Martin Luther King, they think of the 50s and the 60s. But obviously, the struggle for civil rights predates that considerably. What was Du Bois's contribution, shall we say, before the Second World War, in the kind of the interwar years, and even before that?
So Du Bois was one of the pioneers of what we might think of as the long civil rights movement. Starting points are always tricky. There's arguments that can be made that the Black struggle for civil rights began during the antebellum period in the 18th century. But certainly when we think of the modern civil rights movement, we really need to think about it in the context of the late 19th century. And Du Bois was advocating at a time when it was not popular, when it was seen as radical to advocate for uncompromising Black civil rights. He was doing so. He challenged the accommodationist program of Booker T. Washington, who at the time was considered the leading spokesperson for the race. He established the Niagara Movement, which was founded on an explicit platform of African-American civil rights and inclusion into the body politic. And he was one of the co-founders in 1909 of the NAACP, which would become the leading civil rights organization in throughout much of the 20th century. So Du Bois was really at the forefront of laying the groundwork, laying the foundation for the civil rights movement as we know it today. And he did much of that work in the context of the First World War, as I write about in my book.
Well, and before we come to the First World War, you mentioned this accommodationist movement and Booker T. Washington. Obviously, Booker T. Washington was, I'm guessing, probably before the First World War, the more high profile of the two figures. Obviously, kind of his autobiography, which I think was Up From Slavery. He was a hugely successful and famous book. And Du Bois took issue with Booker T. Washington. And the nature of the debate, I think I can kind of paraphrase it as Washington saying, well, Black people will have to be more realistic about what they can achieve. And if they can be kind of pipe fitters and bricklayers for white people, then that's, you know, a good thing. And maybe things can come from that. But stop protesting and stop demanding things. You have to show that you are kind of good Black people. Kind of something on those lines, wasn't it?
Yeah, go to a whole episode to Booker T. Washington.
Well, please come back for that one, by the way. Please.
He was incredibly complex, just like Du Bois was. I kind of liken him to an onion. You have to peel back the layers of Booker T. Washington and his public persona versus his private persona, and kind of all the work and machinations he was doing behind the scenes. He was from the South. He understood the South, and he recognized that it was important for African-American Southerners in particular to work within the confines of a racialized Jim Crow society, and within those confines to do the best that they could, which meant acquiring property, becoming skilled laborers, recognizing the realities, the harsh realities of their situation, but also taking advantage of those realities in whatever way they could. The conflict between Booker T. Washington and Du Bois was certainly personal on some levels, but it was also ideological. It was programmatic. Du Bois was an advocate of liberal arts, higher education of African Americans becoming more than just industrial laborers, as Booker T. Washington advocated through the Tuskegee Institute. And he believed that African Americans should indeed fight for their civil rights. And that Booker T. Washington ultimately was not fit to be the spokesperson, to be a leader for African Americans in the ways that he catered to white Americans, and particularly Northern white capitalists in courting their financial support and ultimately legitimizing the subjugation of African Americans on a national scale.
Yeah. And so what it would be great to do is like you said, to talk about Booker T. Perhaps another time it would be great. I think it would be a fantastic conversation, and there's so much complexity in there. So coming on to the First World War, Du Bois was in Europe, wasn't he, at the time the war broke out? From reading the book, he's quite a kind of Europhile sort of figure, really, isn't he?
He wasn't in Europe, but his wife and daughter were, which was definitely an interesting decision on Du Bois's part to allow his daughter to go to school in England, to allow his wife to accompany her. Kind of speaks to Du Bois's very suspect skills as a father and a husband. But he had a personal connection to the war from the start, as I write about in the book. And he also had a personal connection in terms of his past relationships, the past time that he had spent in Europe, in Germany specifically, as a graduate student, and then later in London and Paris in 1900. So he definitely had a connection to Europe. And for this reason, he was genuinely taken aback when the war erupted, because he believed deeply in this idea of kind of European Enlightenment civilization, rationality, that Europe couldn't erupt into the bloody civil war that it did, because its cultural and intellectual and political and economic ties were so tight. So Du Bois was really kind of shook to his core when war erupted in August of 1914.
And I get the sense, looking at his early life, particularly in Germany and sort of his travels in Europe, that he was almost saw himself as kind of part of the kind of like the European bourgeoisie, you know, sort of like this kind of generation of really kind of educated refinement and so the First World War, I think what happens with Du Bois, you know, he obviously during the war advocates for African Americans to fight for particular reasons, that it would establish them as, if I'm right in thinking, as kind of establish their credentials in terms of citizenship and as kind of valid Americans alongside everybody else. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, wherever you look in the world in kind of August of 1914 and later on, from the kind of the labor movements across Europe to people like Gandhi, there are people saying, yes, there are things that can be had from this war.
Right.
And so Du Bois is actually, you know, what he thinks isn't wildly uncommon, I don't think, at the time. Or there were people thinking, well, whilst we don't want to fight this war and send our young, you know, working class men or African-American men or Indian men to the front line, the alternative of whoever we're talking about, the bad guys winning, is so much worse. But when does Du Bois first begin talking about the possible advantages of African Americans fighting in the war?
Really at the beginning of the war. I mean, once he kind of recovers from his initial shock, he shifts into Du Bois, the preeminent intellectual scholar, analysis of the global scene, and he writes some of the most insightful articles and essays about the origins of the war. He publishes The African Roots of War in the Atlantic Monthly in 1915, one of the most brilliant essays, I would argue, of the 20th century, where he talks about how, in order to understand the coming of war, we need to think about the development of modern imperialism in the context of global capitalism, the exploitation of Africa and other peoples of African descent throughout the world, how the rivalries that had built up in Europe around this kind of insatiable desire for colonies and empire and wealth had led to the eruption of war in 1914. So he's really advancing an analysis of the war and its origins that is wholly original. I mean, certainly you can point to Lenin and his writings in 1915, other radical writers like Karl Kautsky, but Du Bois was really wholly original in his analysis of the war. And quite frankly, it's an interpretation of the war that historians today are still reckoning with in how we write about, how we think about, how we teach about World War.
Oh, for sure, yeah. And it's really, really radical stuff for the time. And And you mentioned that, I think there's kind of Lenin and Rosa Luxemburg, and there was an English liberal intellectual in about 1902 called J.A. Hobson, who said it's essentially sort of war and expansionism and empire and capital are all sort of tied together in this horrible mess, from which, you know, lots of people drew their ideas from.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And when, after sort of, you know, he writes about these kinds of things, does Du Bois actually do sort of kind of active kind of campaigning for African-Americans to sign up? Does he sort of engage on that level?
So when the United States enters the war, at least officially, in April of 1917, Du Bois is faced with a choice. He was anti-war, at least in principle. He considered himself to be a pacifist, but he also had a deep reverence for the Black military tradition, going back to the American Revolution, certainly the Civil War. He had family members, including his father, who served a brief stint in the Union Army during the Civil War. So he understood and appreciated, kind of akin to Frederick Douglass before him, this relationship between war, Black military service, and the potential expansion of African-American citizenship and the broader expansion of democracy. When Woodrow Wilson enters the war, or enters the United States in the war, with his grandiose claim that the world must be made safe for democracy, that resonates with Du Bois. Certainly his understanding of democracy is much different than Woodrow Wilson, who was a white supremacist. Du Bois is thinking about the potential of the war to expand democracy domestically for African Americans, but also for peoples of African descent more broadly. And this relates back to his, you know, really bold and at the time radical conception of the color line, the problem of the 20th century being the problem of the color line, and thinking about the potential of this war to destabilize the color line and create a moment of possibility for African Americans and other peoples of African descent to stake claim to their citizenship more narrowly, but also to democracy more broadly. And that's why he makes the very controversial decision, at least in terms of his own ideals and beliefs, his own principles, to support the war and encourage African Americans to support their country unconditionally.
And there's a kind of a moment that begins where in early 1917, and I don't know quite how long it lasts for. But, you know, before February 1917 and the Russian Revolution, you have three imperialist powers fighting two other imperialist powers, and nobody is talking about democracy. The British are not fighting a war for democracy. 40% of British soldiers didn't have the right to vote because they were working class. And then all of a sudden, you have the Tsarist regime collapse and it's replaced by the provisional government, which possibly might become something liberal and democratic, you never know. And then in April, America joins the war, and all of a sudden, and this is led, I think, particularly by British propagandists, there is this kind of, oh, look, we're fighting this war for civilization against barbarism, for democracy and the torch of liberty and all that kind of stuff. And I guess it would be possible in that context, if you were someone like Du Bois, to look at all this and go, wow, this is the moment. Mm-hmm. And that kind of takes you to all the way through to, I suppose, to the hopes and dreams of the Paris Peace Conference, which mm-hmm. is perhaps where to look next. The thing I didn't know about him, I mean, I could write a book about things I didn't know about Du Bois. The thing I didn't know about him is he was at the Paris Peace Conference. Every time I look at the Paris Peace Conference, there's somebody else there. I think, oh, crikey, I didn't know where they were there.
Yeah.
And he was very, I mean, he was a busy guy there, wasn't he? You know, he's did a lot. What was he trying to achieve there?
So I think to understand the significance of Du Bois being in France, you know, an incredible 3-month period from December of 1918 to March of 1919, we have to understand what happened to him during the war, and how he puts his credibility on the line in supporting the war, but taking it even further by encouraging African-Americans to, as he wrote in arguably his most controversial article in the Crisis magazine, which he edited, to close ranks. He writes this article, Close Ranks, encouraging Black people to forget their special grievances, to put aside all of their grievances and protests against Jim Crow, against lynching, against economic exploitation, et cetera, and to support their country and the Allies, making the argument that first your country and then your rights. And this is explosive. Du Bois is criticized like no other moment in his life. His harshest critics accuse him of being a traitor to the race. And for someone like Du Bois, who dedicated his entire life to supporting African-American civil rights, to uplifting the race, this was the most harsh criticism that you could levy at him. Mm-hmm. So by the end of the war, Du Bois is in a very precarious position. His credibility is being questioned. His radicalism is being questioned. And he's questioning himself. You know, was it the correct decision to support this war, given all the criticism that I'm receiving? So he approaches the peace conference as an opportunity to kind of test the validity of his decision to support the war. But in addition to that, he's also doing research. Du Bois begins working on a book on the Black experience in the war, and he uses the opportunity of the peace conference to start doing essentially ethnographic field research, to talk directly to African-American soldiers and officers, and to see for himself just what happened in France and what this war meant. So his time in France, where he also organizes a landmark Pan-African Congress, is such an important moment in Du Bois's relationship to the history of the war that he begins to write, which is the subject of my book, but also making the war no longer abstract. It's very real for Du Bois at this point. He's literally going to the camps where Black soldiers are located. He's visiting the battlefields. He's standing in the trenches. He's seeing the devastation of the Western Front. And he comes to grips with just this horrific moment in the history of modernity. And he begins to reckon with the war in a way that would continue really throughout certainly the interwar period and throughout his entire life.
And that must have been a moment of crisis for him.
Absolutely.
Seeing what he had advocated for in up close and in his full ugliness.
It was. And Du Bois being the intellectual that he was, the way that he dealt with any type of crisis, particularly such a deeply personal existential crisis as he was facing when it came to the war, was to write about it, to write a book about it. And that's what he tried to do. As I write about in my book, he devoted over 20 years to trying to write what would have been the definitive history of the Black experience in the war, this monumental book that he titled The Black Man and the Wounded World. And he wrote 800 pages of just really incredible manuscript, but ultimately was not able to finish this book. And I think that speaks to really his tortured relationship with the war and how he was not able to fully reckon with it on a personal level, but also on an intellectual and political level as well.
And was the what led to him being unable to finish?
A number of factors. Certainly, there were practical considerations. He was always busy. He was writing other books. He was involved in a number of different issues. So he was always being distracted with other projects. He had struggled to get funding for the project. He applied to pretty much every major philanthropy and foundation for support and was by and large rejected. They didn't see the value of his book, its popular appeal, but also the arguments that he was making in the book as well were deemed too radical or controversial. But ultimately, it was Du Bois himself who was the problem when it came to completing his book. He had to accept the harsh reality that the war was a failure, and that his support for the war was a failure, especially by World War II. And he comes to the harsh realization that there's no audience for his book, given the state of the world, that the lessons of the First World War had not been heeded. That was what was ultimately what caused him to give up on trying to finish and publish his book. The war was a subject matter that was too disillusioning, too tragic for even Du Bois to fully comprehend and to fully write it.
And it's almost as if I get a sense that the war, Du Bois' support for it, and then that realization of seeing the trenches, and then the attempt to write the history of the war is one of the kind of like the central crises of his life.
It really is. This was an experience, as I write about in my book, that transformed Du Bois on so many different levels. Certainly on a personal level, politically, intellectually. As I argue in my book, we can't understand Du Bois's growth. We can't understand his evolution over the course of the 20th century without understanding his relationship to the First World War and his struggles to write about it. When we talk about Du Bois, as we began our conversation in 1963, by this time, he's an uncompromising radical peace activist. Mm-hmm. In the 1950s, the federal government tries to put him in jail. 1951, he's indicted on charges of being an agent of a foreign principal because of his anti-war activities. And that is really the beginnings of his, you know, reckoning with the United States and ultimately his decision to leave the United States altogether. We can't understand Du Bois's evolution into a radical peace activist without understanding how the First World War and its failure drove him to that point.
Yeah.
So as I argue in my book, the First World War is so much more about just the book that Du Bois was trying to write. It's about understanding him and his political and ideological evolution, but also understanding his place in the broader struggle for African-American citizenship and freedom in the 20th century.
I think I'm just on one final thought, is that I think the value of a book like the one that you've written is that it presents the intellectual not as a static entity. You know, again, if you compare him to another 20th century intellectual, let's go back to the example of George Orwell. George Orwell, of course, if you read his any biography of him, is on a journey of ideas throughout his life. And most people all people really are on some kind of intellectual journey. But for the public intellectual, some of the positions that they start off with are very, very different from where they end up. And I think it's examining that intellectual journey that's kind of the real heart of the book that you've written there.
Right. I wanted to present Du Bois as a human. I wanted to humanize him in a way that I think a lot of writings about Du Bois have not fully done. To recognize his greatness, his brilliance, but also his flaws, to recognize the ways in which he was very problematic in his dealings with other people, and dealing with himself, being truly honest and forthright with himself, but also acknowledging that when we think about Du Bois, one of his greatest contributions to how we think about African-American struggles for civil rights, African-American intellectual history, was his capacity for change. And I think looking at Du Bois in that way provides a new opportunity to really appreciate him in all of his brilliance and all of his messiness as well.
Well, and it's the messiness I'm always attracted to, but there we must finish, Chad. It's been an honor to talk with you. And the Wounded World is available now in all good retailers. Please, if you're listening to this, try to support an independent retailer. Amazon have got more money than they can ever spend. But please, please, please buy this book from the independent retailers if you can do. Chad, it'd be a pleasure to talk to you again, perhaps on related topics. I hope you'll come back and join us again. And thank you so much for your time. It's been wonderful.
All right. Thank you.
Cool. Take good care.